Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
Suburban women, will you please like me? Remember? Please. Please. I saved your damn neighborhood, okay?
Republican Glenn Youngkin has never held elected office, but he sold himself as a political outsider while trying to rally suburban voters around hot-button issues like how to handle the discussion of racism in schools and mask mandates. And it worked.
Candidates need to appeal to suburban voters. That's the message from pundits and politicians from presidential races on down the ballot. But when suburban voters hear descriptions of themselves, do they feel represented?
We are left out of that demographic.
That's Ravita Rachman, a mom of two in Williamson County, Tennessee.
The things that you talk about when you talk of suburban moms don't always reflect the diversity of those communities.
The term suburban moms is often code for white women in the suburbs, and it fails to capture who today's suburban voter really is. Over the past several decades, the suburbs have grown increasingly more diverse. But parents like Rachman say descriptions of suburban life don't always include the voices of Black parents like herself. Rachman says it's not just about how outsiders describe communities like hers, but even within the suburban area, diversity is not always recognized or valued. She lives in Williamson County. The school district has made headlines for heated school board meetings and a recent decision to limit the teaching of some books because parents argued they wouldn't be age appropriate.
There's a school in our district that is known for the disproportional rates of discipline on Black boys, particularly. So we had a goal of getting our district to hire a consultant to come in, do an equity audit, evaluate what students were saying, what teachers were saying, get all those perspectives and pull that together to come and give the district an idea of how they can make a strategic plan to make sure that race is something thought about in the future. We had a lot of people that were disputing that and saying, you know, why are we spending money on this for this? And it was striking to me that they didn't want us to hire a diversity consultant, but you're okay with them spending 20-something million on a football field.
Suja Amir, a mom in Henrico County, Virginia, says she doesn't think leaders in some suburbs even try to connect with diverse members of their communities. Henrico County hasn't seen the same level of conflict as Williamson County, but Amir says she's concerned about the reaction she sees from other suburban parents about things like critical race theory.
I really just want my children to be kind. I want them to be good people. And I really get scared when I think about what our kids are growing up and seeing. Turn on the news and I see like parents are like going to school and like fighting teachers and school board members. I'm like, what? That's what's happening now? No, let's not react to these things in this manner.
So today on Point, we're going to examine the growing diversity in the suburbs. Who really lives in the suburbs today? What can we learn about their experiences and what it means when we talk about suburban voters? Joining us now is LaRue Lewis-McCoy. He's a sociology professor at New York University who studies race and inequality in the suburbs. He's also the author of Inequality in the Promised Land, Race, Resources, and Suburban Schooling. Professor Lewis-McCoy, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me today.
And is it okay if I call you LaRue during our conversation?
Absolutely fine.
So I want to start. We're hearing from these parents in the suburbs. We've heard in recent election cycles how increasingly there has been a focus on the suburbs. Sort of help us understand, when did the suburbs really become such a key constituency in politics?
Yeah. You know, the suburbs, for better or for worse, in many people's imaginations right now are pretty hot. And we saw with the last election cycle, whether it was the gubernatorial election in Virginia or the presidential election, that people are calling out to the suburbs and saying we need to court suburban voters. And that appeal to suburban voters has an earlier root, probably closer to the 1970s and 80s. When we think about what happened with major metropolitan cities in the 1960s and 1970s, you had the concentration of poverty within cities. Those who had the economic means tended to move outside of the city into suburban areas. And there was also the movement of jobs away from the cities to the suburbs or to other countries. And what happened was the idea of the American dream really crystallized along the suburban frontier. So in that way, by the time you get to the 1960s and 70s, you have politicians explicitly saying, I know I have to capture the vote inside of Boston as well as the vote outside of Boston. And the appeal to the suburban voters coming out of the 1970s and 80s, even through the 1990s, was often an appeal targeted directly at where they thought middle income and above white residents were. So there's a longer history of an appeal to a suburban voter. But more recently, this appeal to the suburban voter gets complicated in part based on who's there now and what a individual politician may be signaling when they say they want to get the suburban voter.
And so let's back up a little bit and talk about how the suburbs formed and how the demographics of the suburbs were shaped. Lisa Rice is the president and CEO of the National Fair Housing Alliance. And she says that during the New Deal era, there was a series of restrictive policies that shaped the modern suburb.
For example, they can say, if you want to build a home here, you have to use certain materials. But we also saw restrictive covenants that were tied to race and national origin. So, for example, there would be an inclusion of language that forbade the ability of a homeowner or a property owner to sell land or sell a home to Blacks or to Latinos or to Chinese Americans or to Jewish people.
So, LaRue, we had suburbs that were intentionally formed in many ways to be white, to have this, to look like where the Cleavers lived or where the Brady Bunch lived. But at the same time, we still saw a growing diversity nonetheless, particularly in recent decades. I'm Black. I grew up in the suburbs in Michigan. So explain that disconnect between what is actually happening and how people have sort of come to think of suburbs.
Yeah, I think the canonical example of the suburb is the one that was developed after World War II. They took a plot of farmland and they built out a set of often cookie cutter houses. And there they would define how big the house was. They would make sure it had similar plumbing. They made sure they had common streets and sidewalks. But those covenants were also pretty significant, as Rice mentioned. You would have areas where Black people could build homes, could do the plumbing, could pick up the trash, but they were restricted from living in. And so what happened was in those predominantly white suburbs that were central to the suburbanization of America, there were also suburban spaces that were developed that had large concentrations of color. So we now know that there were a number of Black suburbs and Black settlements that existed alongside or separate from the white suburbs that developed. Now, in particular, those Black suburbs usually were not as affluent or not as well resourced, but there has actually been a history of Black people and non-white folks and Asian folks in the suburbs. What happens, though, over time is that when there are people with more economic means started to move out into the suburbs, the challenges of the city emerge, but intergenerational challenges often emerge. So maybe you were the child of a college-educated family that found refuge in a nice suburb outside of the city. And while your parents love the suburbs, when you completed college, the last place you wanted to be were the suburbs. You said, well, the suburbs are boring. The suburbs are tired. I don't want to drive everywhere. And so you had a migration from the suburbs back into central cities. And what we've seen, particularly in the last 2 to 3 decades, is as middle class and above residents, particularly white middle class and above residents, return to cities. Many of those cities that have been places where Black folks have been, Asian folks have been, Latinx folks have been, they have found the ability to secure housing in the city is compromised. So the prices of a downtown rent in 1985 look very different than in 2005. And so then those lower income folks have to say, well, where can I afford to live? And oftentimes they started to migrate back out into the suburbs. So that would mean sometimes they would go right across the city line into an inner ring suburb. And with that migratory pattern, what you started to find is that more people were pushed into the suburbs, but this time not so much by choice, but this time by circumstance, which has led now to us now having more poor residents in the suburbs than we do in central cities, having more Black residents in the suburbs than we do central cities, and on down the line.
So this phenomenon that you're talking about created more not just racial and ethnic diversity in the suburbs, but economic diversity within the suburbs. Why don't we see that reflected in the way that we hear politicians and members of the media talk about the suburbs?
I think we have a really strong imagination of what the suburbs are. So as you mentioned before, when you say suburban, you think of something like Leave It to Beaver or the Dick Van Dyke Show, or even more contemporary examples, maybe even something that looks like Blackish. And everyone who's in the suburbs seems to have enough money. They've created their own little cottage curated space. But the issue with that is often it misses out on the folks who are poor. One of the dimensions of the suburbs that we have to think about also is how private things are. It's the idea you have your own space, your own domicile. So when it comes to a question of, well, are people experiencing poverty? Oftentimes that's not polite conversation. We can see in the suburbs over the past two decades an immense increase in foreclosures, but folks don't talk about what does it mean to have a house where you've missed mortgage payments? What does it mean to own a home where you're now underwater on the mortgage? This is a suburban experience, but that's not the kind of conversation we often like to have. The other thing that often happens is in suburban communities, we think about single family homes. As more folks have moved into the suburbs, the question of where can you rent? Where can you find affordable rent? And how do apartments and homes mix? So these are the questions of actually addressing the new suburban reality that we face.
All right, we're going to pause for a moment. We are talking about diversity in the suburbs. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about the growing diversity in the suburbs and what that means for the experiences of low-income and BIPOC families. And joining us is LaRue Lewis-McCoy. He's a sociology professor at NYU who studies race and inequality in the suburbs. So when we left off before the break, we were talking about the qualities of suburbs. But I want to talk a little bit about that and also the white-dominated narrative of the suburbs and whether that was by mistake by the idea of Leave It to Beaver and the other things we were talking about, or what parts of it are intentional. And I want to go back to Lisa Rice. She says that the former Federal Housing Administration's chief economist, Homer Hoyt, created a system that supported a racial homogeneity.
Scandinavians, people of British descent, Scottish descent, Irish descent, they're number one on his chart. And African-Americans and Mexicans are at the very bottom of the chart. And so what that means is if you've got a racially homogenous community that is comprised of Anglo-Saxon whites, for example, that community is going to be given the highest value in terms of property values. If you have a community where it's racially diverse and you have Black people and Latino people and Chinese people living in the community, it's given a lower value just by sheer virtue of the fact that there are people of color living in the area.
So then you fast forward to the 21st century and you have politicians talking about suburbs in a way that seems to reinforce this sort of zoned segregation that we saw in the building of the suburbs. For example, former President Donald Trump had consistently claimed that Democrats would, quote, destroy the suburbs as we know it. Here he is in July of 2020.
Your home will go down in value and crime rates will rapidly rise. Joe Biden and his bosses from the radical left want to significantly multiply what they're doing now. And what will be the end result is you will totally destroy the beautiful suburbs.
So, LaRue, I want to ask you, how much about how we think about the suburbs and how the suburbs were formed was based out of genuine concern about safety and home values, you know, things that all homeowners care about, and how much of it was about segregation and dog whistling?
That's a great question. I think absolutely. I've never met a person who didn't want to live in a safe community. I've never met a person who owned a home who didn't want that house to go up in value. But very much the appeals that we have seen more recently to this idea that the suburbs are being destroyed, or as Trump used, that they want to abolish the suburbs, are very explicit dog whistles. They are meant not to actually connect to who's in the suburbs, but they're meant to connect to white voters. White voters who may feel like they've been aggrieved, that time has passed them by, that they don't have the opportunity to live in the ideal community that they wanted to. Trump was very much saying, I will return you to a place of kind of a white utopia. Now, Trump was also very aware that the suburbs themselves had been diversified for some time and that most folks who have homes in suburbia still have high value in their homes. And most suburbs are overwhelmingly safe. But he also knew that you have to speak in a way to rally people around an idea. And so this history of structural segregation, of institutional separation between groups, it leads into a present in which politicians draw on the imagery of the past and the structures of the past to try to create a road to the future. And so when I think about who's in suburbs and who we need to be talking to, I often think about folks who are single head of households. I think about immigrant families, because there are now more immigrant families in the suburbs than in central cities. I think about BIPOC families, because the majority of students of color attend schools in the suburbs rather than in central cities. And when people make these appeals to the suburbs as a place that used to be good or a place that used to have high value and used to be white, we actually miss out on who is there and what's happening in real time.
Yeah, I think it's an important point to underscore in what you just said right now. I don't think people even realize that more people of color live in suburbs than in city centers, and that is the largest percentage. So I want to talk about ways that we have seen these racialized tensions in the suburbs come up in recent years. And I want to start with the Black Lives Matter movement. It seemed that when that movement first started in the mid-teens, there was a lot of antipathy toward it. It was treated as something negative. But then after the death of George Floyd, there seemed to be a shift where there was a it seemed, at least visibly, a lot of support for the Black Lives Movement in suburbs. You saw a lot of parents, not just parents of color, but a lot of white parents as well, marching. You saw the signs in neighborhoods. Talk a little bit about how that phenomenon resonated in the suburbs.
Yes. Yeah, so Black Lives Matter is a very important movement. And for me, a significant portion of Black Lives Matter is a suburban tale. So we can think about, unfortunately, the killing of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida, which is a suburb of Orlando, which was the beginning moment that we even heard the flickering of the term Black Lives Matter. And then, of course, the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, which is in St. Louis County, which is, again, a suburb of the city of St. Louis. Ferguson itself used to be a sundown town. That is a town where black folks were not able to be after sundown unless they faced some form of racial violence. But in the 1970s and 80s, it rapidly transitioned to become a majority black suburb. And so as the nation started to think about this idea of extrajudicial police killings, we can look at whether it's Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or Corinne Gaines. There's a lot of encounters where black people meet the police and die at the hands of the police, and they're in suburban spaces. And so while in the beginning we didn't talk about the suburbs, we actually see this conversation start to evolve during the summer of 2020, because as people took to the streets after the death of George Floyd, it wasn't just in the middle of the city. It wasn't just in Minneapolis. It was in all outlying areas. We found, and one of the things that I thought was amazing was I got a lot of people reaching out to me saying, hey, you know, my community wants to do a march around racial justice. And while we haven't had anyone who's been, that we know of, killed at the hands of police, we know that our black residents are more likely to be pulled over. We know that our Latino residents are more likely to get harassed when they're downtown. And they started to move a conversation about equity and justice and policing to the suburbs. Now, one of the sad things is that as people have thought about ending extrajudicial police violence and ending the use of force, they only have tended to think about that within central cities. So a lot of people have been talking about police reform in central cities, but have done very little outside of them. So when we look at a place like Ferguson, when the U.S. Justice Department investigated them, they found that there were actually more tickets issued to black people than there were black people in the town of Ferguson, meaning many of these suburban communities are using ticketing and citation and arrest as a way to bolster their economy at the expense of the residents who are there. So there's a lot that is now starting to happen where we have to make sure that the conversations that we've had for a long time in cities are also happening in suburbs so that we can actually have justice wherever there are people who are in need of it.
And as a different point where we have seen the politics of suburbia really catch fire is over the issue of critical race theory. Now, we know that that is a legal theory that really is not taught in elementary schools, but it has become the catchphrase for something broader, for historical teachings that include things like the transatlantic slave trade and its ongoing impact on American culture. We saw that really focused in the suburbs. Talk a little bit about how that came up.
Yes. So just as the uprisings of 2020 produced more conversations in the suburbs about justice than we've ever seen before, that backlash, that racial reckoning was really a recalibration. So we have seen across the nation, and particularly in the suburbs, a concerted effort to push back against as what I often call the boogeyman of critical race theory. So anytime you start to think about race, you start to think about racism, then that's got to be critical race theory. Now, we know that's not what it is, but that's what's organizing people. And while it has been very significant to the suburbs, I think it's also important to understand that this pushback against critical race theory is not simply a grassroots phenomenon. In fact, it's an astroturf phenomenon. That is, there's a concerted effort, right? So we can look back at the work of folks like Chris Rufo and the Manhattan Institute to say, hey, I'll teach you how to go to your school board, and I'll teach you how to tell them not to teach critical race theory. I'll give you the language to submit to the school board and the resolutions to pass. So this isn't really on the ground a set of parents coming up and waking up one day and saying, gosh, this theory is so troubling. It is folks who are trying to push back against the ability to talk about justice, the actual act of creating inclusion and curricula that starts to address the needs of all of our students. So in the suburbs, whether it's Virginia, whether it's Georgia, we've seen a knee-jerk reaction. And the goal has been to activate, in particular, white suburban residents to go up to the podium, to stand at the dais and say, we reject critical race theory. Now, what that does for the families who are actually in the suburbs, I think about my nephew, who is an African-American boy in a suburb of Atlanta, and his county has banned critical race theory. What that says to my nephew and this family is that our experience is not welcome. So the same way in which the restricted covenants functioned earlier on to keep families out of particular suburban spaces, I think if we're not careful, this movement against critical race theory will actually tell families that are non-white, families that are concerned with justice, equity, and inclusion, that you're not welcomed in these places. So this is a really important place to watch, and the suburbs are often the battlegrounds for it, because the suburbs are actually the place where we see the greatest amount of diversity, where people from different walks of life in race, ethnicity, and poverty actually interact.
So I want to drill down on this a little bit more, this AstroTurf phenomenon that you're talking about, where an easy to understand message is delivered to a certain constituency, and then it takes off within that. Because I think a lot of times when we are talking about critical race theory, it's painted in a way where you have, parents that are being painted as racist, and then they're called racist, and then they recoil even more. But what I have seen, even among the people who are fearful of critical race theory, is that it seems to be a genuine concern about their children, right? Mm-hmm. These are some of the same parents who were also concerned about the death of George Floyd and who supported Black Lives Matter. How can these things be happening at the same time in the same suburbs?
Yeah, I think part of it is that there's always a question of tipping point in progress, right? How far are people willing to go? And when it is a distant violation, something like the death of George Floyd, and you can rationalize, no one should be forced to lay face down on the ground. No one should have a neck on their back for 9 minutes. That is absolutely unjust. It's different than when you say, hey, do you know in your school they may actually be teaching about the history of this town's segregation? Maybe you live in a suburb that you love. Maybe you're in a place like Oak Park, Illinois, that celebrates its diversity. But it doesn't talk about its history in which racialized violence happened. So when Black residents moved in, maybe they experienced firebombing. And if a teacher brings that into the classroom, now even that kind of utopia, that perfect world of racial harmony and diversity that you imagined, that veneer gets scratched off. And we see, no matter what community we're in, there's a long history of racism and difference. And oftentimes, when things get closer to home, the same people who said, I want to stand for justice, justice for George Floyd, say, wait a second. Like, don't talk about my grandparents or my grandparents' grandparents, because it was a different time. And that close to home nature is one of the things that I think that the AstroTurf movements to try to push back against critical race theory are playing on. They're saying, well, you already made a choice to move to a place that was diverse. And now they want to teach you that your children, if your child is white, that they're a victimizer. And if your child is a child of color, that they're a victim. The truth of the matter is that that's not what culturally responsive education does. That's not what we see in the curriculum. But as parents hear these messages over and over again, that your child will be identified as a victimizer, and if you're a child of color, they'll be identified as a victim, they say, I don't want that for my child. One of the most important things I think we can do is have those same parents who are operating out of a place of fear actually engage with their school board and engage with their schools, not in an accusatory fashion, but actually asking to understand, what is it that you do? Because what often happens is when you see what's actually happening in schools, you start at a different point of engagement instead of assuming the worst that's happening for your kids.
So we've heard parents pushing back against things like critical race theory. But what about parents of color like Ravita Rachman, who went to her school board concerned about the disparate discipline that Black children seem to be having? Do they have the same kind of voices and the same kind of power that we've seen parents in recent months going to school board meetings pushing back against critical race theory?
Unfortunately not. I think it is absolutely important that we also recognize that the greatest rates of disproportionate suspension, both in school and out of school, tend to be in affluent suburban areas. One of the things that I know from my research is that when parents go to suburban schools and say, I want things to change, white parents, middle-income parents are listened to very differently than BIPOC parents and non-affluent parents. Oftentimes, parents who are Black and Latinx, when they ask the school to address issues around disparities in school suspension, disparities in access to AP classes, disparities in making sure that children have equitable play spaces, they're told, well, we've already done enough to try to address this because these districts have historically educated largely white populations. And rather than being listened to, they get pushed back against. Whereas for white families, when they go to a district and say, I'm not sure I like the way things are being taught, the district responds in a very quick fashion to try to figure out how to appease those families so that they won't leave the school systems. It's a very dangerous thing. I think one of the most important things that families that care about equity and justice, and this is in particular BIPOC families and families who are allies of BIPOC families, is make sure that you start the conversations around school discipline, school curriculum, around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and organize as a unit. Because if you show up at a school board meeting and there are 15 parents reading from the same script that critical race theory is bad, which they've downloaded from a website, and there are 5 parents who are speaking in a very passionate fashion about why their children need to be included, those 15 parents will always get further in pushing against critical race theory than those 5 who have a desire to actually create just and inclusive communities.
All right, we're going to ask our guest, LaRue Lewis-McCoy, to hold for just one moment. We are discussing the growing diversity in the suburbs and what that means for the experiences of low-income and BIPOC families. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. You know, there's an alarming statistic out there that caught our attention here at On Point. Since 1990, the percentage of Americans who say they don't have a single close friend has quadrupled, according to the Survey Center on American Life. 12% of those surveyed last May don't have a single close friend. And the pandemic has only made matters worse. Nearly half of those surveyed had lost touch with a few friends over the past year, and nearly 1 in 10 reporting lost touch with most of their friends. So the question we want to explore later this week is what happened? Why do Americans have fewer close friends, and what's the impact on our lives? But we want to hear from our listeners. Have you lost touch with your friends recently? Has your friend circle shrunk? And are you in a new city, perhaps, struggling to meet new people? What impact has this had on your life? If you have still managed to keep your close friends, how have you done it? And what value have your friends brought to your lives? We want to hear from you. So give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 653-0683. 3. Today, we're talking about the growing diversity in the suburbs and what that means for the experiences of low-income and BIPOC families. We're joined by LaRue Lewis-McCoy. He's a sociology professor at NYU who studies race and inequality in the suburbs. Julie Collins is a grandmother in Westerville, Ohio, and an organizer of Red, Wine, and Blue, a national network of multiracial suburban women mobilizing to counter disruptive advocacy groups masquerading as grassroots movements. We asked her if she felt included when she hears the term suburban.
Not always, no. And in fact, most of the time, no. it's clear when the politicians are talking about suburban women, they typically mean suburban white women. But, you know, we know that the suburbs are diverse. And we know that, you know, moms come from everywhere.
Currently, one of Red, Wine, and Blue's ongoing efforts includes pushing back against book bans being promoted by other parents.
They couch their argument that these books make white children feel bad and they make children of color victims. And all of that is a lie. Nobody is concerned about Ruby Bridges' story, you know, in terms of it being something that would be harmful to children. We think that that's something that the children actually need to know. And, you know, a lot of these books that they're trying to ban at this moment have been out for decades. And this is just really frustrating in terms of, you know, looking at it from a Black woman's perspective, they're trying to erase my history.
Collins is referring there to the attempted banning of Ruby Bridges Goes to School and the story of Ruby Bridges, children's books that tell the story of the first Black child to attend what had been an all-white elementary school in the South.
We live in the same space, but in different spaces all at the same time. And it's not always pleasant. It's not always fun, but it is the reality of living in America, actually, and being a person of color. What I'm looking at with these book bans right now is not only are they banning books that are about folks of color, but they're also banning, you know, books that are about the LGBTQ community as well. And so, you know, I cannot help but think that the children that are sitting there that are of color, that are LGBTQ, are feeling like, well, if they don't want books about us, how can we possibly be welcome?
Collins says her hope is that the group's efforts would ultimately allow children to receive a full and well-rounded education in schools.
I want folks to understand that we are not demonizing the parents on the other side of this issue. We know that they care about their children and we care about our children. You know, we just want our children to be taught the truth.
That's Julie Collins. She's a grandmother in Westerville, Ohio, and an organizer with Red, Wine, and Blue. Now, LaRue, this sort of gets to the point that we left off, where we left off before the break about coalition politics, how parents can act, what parents can do to make sure that they are seen, that their concerns are heard, and that they their elected officials are responsive. How does that work?
Well, I think it works in just the way that Judy Collins outlined, right? It's one, coalition politics are not about demonization. You may have someone who is reading from a script who thinks they are doing the best for their child, and they don't realize the collateral consequences. Particularly in suburban spaces, coalition politics work well when you start with listening. So you may have a town that has a majority white population, but also has a significant presence of Latino folks and Asian American folks. And when you look at a thing like a school board, you have to look at its composition. And oftentimes we find that while our schools are very diverse in suburban spaces, our school boards are not, meaning the people who make decisions around the budget of schools, people who make decisions, even the degree to which curriculums can change, don't reflect the diversity. So when we're building coalition politics in the suburbs, I always say, well, look at the school board and figure out who isn't present and whose voice needs to be represented. You want to look at who shows up in the room, whether it's at the PTA or whether it's at the school board, and say, well, why don't we hear from certain communities? Because while I may be an African-American male and I may be raising children in the suburbs, I may understand my children's experience with discipline and discrimination, but I may not understand my neighbor's experience, who may be undocumented and Hmong. I have to listen and learn from their experience to figure out how to advocate for them. Because when the time comes to speak up at the mic, when the time comes to actually challenge the idea that the curriculum is not inclusive, that the books that are being taught are not helpful, I have to be able to not only elevate my voice, but the chorus around me. And coalition politics in the suburbs work well when people start from a listening position and then they advocate not just for themselves, but for the collective. And you can still advocate for the specifics that your community needs, but you should never do so to the exclusion of the ones that are around you.
Do you think that the narrative that we've heard in national politics, you know, where we have gubernatorial candidates and presidential candidates and folks far up the ballot from your school board members, really driving this conversation in a way that makes this type of coalition politics we're talking about on the local level more difficult?
I think it absolutely does make it more difficult. But if there's one thing about the suburbs that's important, and I've visited and studied a number of suburbs, is that oftentimes people who are in these communities have an investment in these communities and want to make these places special. So if I show up to Brookline, the people in Brookline will tell me what makes Brookline special and different than, say, Cambridge, right? If you really want to have your community be special, then you have to do local organizing and make sure everyone who's within your town, who's within your city, within your village, actually has their voices heard. While politicians are going to make these big bombastic claims or make these grand overtures, remember, these are the people that you're going to live with. So you owe it to yourself and you owe it to your neighbors to start from a posture of local politics are the best politics. And how do we make sure everyone who's in the village actually has a voice?
And sort of what are the steps to do that? I mean, I think about growing up, I always thought when it came to local politics and getting responsiveness from your government that it was the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And my mother was absolutely a squeaky wheel. She showed up to school board meetings and local city council meetings in, you know, that suburban town in Michigan, Oak Park, Michigan. And the mayor and the school board members and people knew who she was. But at the same time, in a way, she had a luxury to do that. She was her career was homemaking, was raising us. And so she had that ability. What about parents who work multiple jobs and who have a lot of other things, particularly in a pandemic, childcare needs and other things that make that a little bit harder?
I think for parents who can't take on the heavy lift that your mother did, that my mother did, that they want to figure out what are the local organizations that they can participate in supporting. So sometimes it's as simple as figuring out what the local NAACP is doing. And sometimes it's as simple as signing on to a petition, right? The more voices you have, the more voices are heard. Not everyone has to be the one who speaks up at the school board meeting, but there are often local efforts where they're looking for the voices, particularly of working class folks in the suburbs. When I go to suburban communities and I look at what their demographics are and then I look at who's in the room, I always ask, well, where are all the folks who are like, you know, living in and around poverty, because they're not in this room. And so it means that even the people who are doing the heavy lifting, you have to check and see who's at the table. And it's not your job just to represent the interests of folks who are not at the table because, you know, somehow you're college educated and you're middle class. It's actually your job to try to get those folks into the room so their interests can be more fully understood. And that's often a step that people don't take, because sometimes even when we are well-meaning, we think we can represent other people's interests without listening first. So I think there are all different ways to participate, from a petition to joining a campaign to selling things at a bake sale. But most importantly, that posture of listening to create a coalition is the first place we have to be.
You know, we were talking about the way the national narrative impacts local politics, but can it be the other way around? I mean, is there a way for these types of coalition politics, or just the way that we think about or talk about these issues, make their way to a higher ground. I mean, I think about a point I think that you made when the discussion over defunding the police and what does abolishing the police look like. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says it looks like policing in the suburbs, which means you can go about your business and really not come across a police officer ever in a lot of communities in a way that you cannot in more urban, in more densely populated, more multicultural communities. So can thinking about things in that way sort of make its way to the national narrative?
I think it can if people are thinking creatively and outside of the box. But what's also important is that when you're doing that organizing, when you're doing that fight back, actually getting the attention of media. Right. So if your district is doing a ban on critical race theory, there's a good chance that the media will show up. But what we don't have oftentimes when the media shows up, they interview the people who desire to have the content banned. They don't interview the folks who say, no, we actually support books that are inclusive and books that tell the whole truth. And when those bans get defeated, we don't get follow-ups. So we actually need those voices to be elevated. All around the nation, there are folks who are trying to turn back the clock, but people are fighting back. I think that when we think about what is possible in our communities, the suburbs can be a place that we look to for inspiration. Because as I mentioned before, they are the place where the rubber meets the road on this question of, do you truly believe in diversity and inclusion? What does equitable work look like? And I've seen across the nation, local communities changing their curricula, local communities training teachers against bias, local communities having coalitions that have pushed out superintendents who they thought didn't actually represent the needs of the whole. But those stories rarely bubble all the way up. And most importantly, when politicians, your local politician, stands up and says that they project an image of the suburbs that is inaccurate, we have the right and the ability to speak back. Because politicians want you on their side, but you have to be clear that when they're not reflecting your reality, it's our responsibility to push them to do something different, and then we'll reframe the narrative for decades to come.
I want to talk a little bit more about the media, about my profession, and the role that they play in all of this. On the one hand, you do see a lot of shorthanding, terms like suburban moms, suburban voters, being used in a way that contains the dog whistle within it. But at the same time, you're talking about who members of the media speak to, how they cover these things. We've also seen a systemic drain on the resources of local news organizations. We're seeing them fall left, right, and center or get consolidated by bigger news organizations. So local news coverage has dwindled so much than it was a couple decades ago. Talk about how both of these phenomena have affected the politics of suburbia.
Of course. In an ideal situation, you have a thriving local media, whether that is a newspaper, whether that is a set of conversations that happen in public around what's changing. But the consolidation of media has often meant that local papers aren't profitable, and things that are local don't produce the returns that allow people to continue. What I've seen in communities that actually helps are having active sites that use platforms like Patch. I've seen community groups using forums like Medium and Facebook and other social media to create an internal dialogue about local politics that has been created by the vacuum of the consolidation of media. I think it also means when those national organizations come to town that they have a responsibility to do some legwork of finding a chorus of voices, not just voices that fit the narrative that they imagine out the gate. The truth of the matter is that if you can build trust in local communities, and I know this as a researcher, as someone who goes around nationally and studies suburbs, the more you build trust in a community by demonstrating you're a person who has the best of intentions, the more you can actually get people to talk to you. And one of the things that we have seen some national media raising concern about is the idea that when they go to these suburban spaces, they can't actually get in contact with people. People are unwilling to speak. Well, the more you broker a trusting relationship, the more you listen, the more you tie to organizations that keep the community at the central, at the center, the better we understand what's happening. It is my hope that the national media starts to cover the commitment to diversity and equity in a way that reflects what's happening on the ground, because 2020, in the summer of 2020, you had thousands of suburban marches for George Floyd that when we look at the media coverage in comparison to suburban book bans get way more attention. So we have to always check what we frame and how we think about things so that we can actually capture what matters to the people on the ground, so that the voices that you captured in this segment, that they actually feel reflected when you talk about suburban voters and suburban communities.
LaRue Lewis-McCoy, he's a sociology professor at New York University who studies race and inequity in the suburbs. He's also the author of Inequality in the Promised Land, Race Resources and Suburban Schooling. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Akinstor. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.